I want to thank you all so much for being here this morning. This has kind of been a long time coming. The effect has been kind of a guerrilla faith community for the last 2 years. And we've been popping up all over South County at various churches and homes doing studies and praise gatherings like we were just doing today. And gatherings and Sunday gatherings in our house. And this is the first time that we're kind of putting 2 feet on the ground in a separate facility. And so it's kind of a new beginning right now. And we're really excited to be here. And, you know, whenever you do something like this, there's always so many people to thank. And there's a few people that I do want to name because it's just been an amazing journey. And, you know, just from Barb Dunnerman, who just did all the hospitality and the coffee. We've got three high school kids that are watching the children right now. We have my wife, who did so much work on all sorts of things, shopping and getting all the things together. You know, you just, what does it take to put a gathering in a building? It's kind of like a camping trip, you know, with stuff all over the place. And these were amazing things that happened. Jeff Jones, you're going to hear from a little bit later, has just been beating the pavement and working so hard. And I especially want to thank Judy and Bob Beecham, who made this facility possible for us. And they've been such an incredible encouragement. Thank you so much for everything that you've done. And it just goes on and on. Even the cup holders here were done by Lisa Hopkins, and Jeff Larson has been a great encouragement. A woman with a drill press. Now, isn't that an amazing thing? I just thought that was the greatest thing. You know, we were talking about, wouldn't it be nice if we had something that just wasn't the silver stuff? And she says, well, do you have a drill press? I do. And it's like, oh, great. You're hired. But she made two of these. It's just, it's amazing. There is so much. And I want to obviously thank God for whatever he's doing in all this. You know, this really is just a great experiment. We have no idea really what we're doing. We know what we would like to do. But we don't know how it's going to turn out. And I think that's the exciting part. If it's all planned out, if we're holding too tightly to our plans, that's when everything starts to come unglued. And so what we want to do is, yes, we have a plan. And no, we're not going to hold on to it too tightly. We're just going to kind of go forward and course correct as we need to and kind of see what happens. But as we put 2 feet on the ground, as we make this new beginning, I think there's a valid question that we need to ask. And that's, why are we here? Why are we here today? Lord knows that South County needs another church about as much as it needs another Starbucks. So that can't be it. There's got to be another reason. You know, before you can answer the question of why we're here today or why you're anywhere doing a specific detail, you have to know why you're here. I mean, there's a larger question. Before we can answer why we're here today, why are we here at all? You know, what's that big question out there? What is the purpose of the time that we spend in our lives, in our skins here in this world? You know, I've been thinking about this. This is important. If any of you went to your workplace or any of you started a job, you would think about it. Would you go there not knowing your purpose in doing what you do? And yet how many people get up every day and they go through their lives without really even thinking about what is the purpose? What's the plan? What are we doing here? It's amazing. But I did it too. And I guess I've been banging around evangelical churches for almost 20 years now. But the first 10 years of that time, my faith, what I did in those churches, and my wife will tell you, I poured tons of time and energy and resources into those churches. And my life did not change one bit. There was no effect to anything that I did in that church, in those churches, in that work that changed who I was. It changed my life. I was still anxious. I was still stressed. I was still obsessively, compulsively doing the things that I did, and nothing changed. What is it about our faith that sometimes doesn't have the capacity to affect our lives? This is what we need to look at. Then, about 7 or 8 years ago, I still remember the night, when suddenly I turned a corner. Suddenly, there was the first glimmer of what God's love must really mean. It took 10 years for me to get to that point. Maybe I'm a slow learner. But I don't want to, you know, be too hard on myself either, because understanding the nature of God's love is one of the hardest things that a finite creature can ever do. How is it that any one of us can actually fathom what a perfect love really means, what an infinite love really means? Think about that for a second. A love that is so vast that it's always on. It's like a fire hydrant. You know, it always gives you more than you can ingest. You can't get away from it. You can't turn it off. You can't turn it down. It's just always there, like the sun burning in every possible direction. All you can do is maybe seek shade, but you can't do anything to dim that love. Now, in our lives, the kind of love that we experience, if it's too good to be true, then it probably is. And that's where this falls into in terms of its category. It's just too good to be true. And so we can't believe it. We can't take the risk that is involved in moving beyond what we think we know to try to experience something brand new. What I realized was that in my life, in those 10 years and all the years before, I was living in fear. You know, you only can live in fear or in love. And the opposite of love is not hate. It's fear. Because fear removes the possibility for us to take the risk to be able to move into the kind of relationship that makes us vulnerable. And so we fear. And the anxiety and the stress and the anger and the depression and all the negative emotions are simply manifestations of fear. Fear is the root of all the stuff in our lives that we'd rather not have, whether we see it as such or not. Perfect love casts out all fear, right? 1 John? But how do you get to a place where you can actually use the love that is perfect to affect your life? It's so difficult to do. I wrote a paper, an article that was published in one of those alternative Christian online magazine kind of thingies, you know, that they get them out there. And it was called The Suburbs of Hell. And the premise of the thing was, is that we as Christians who are still living in fear obsess over hell. Let any conversation among Christians go on long enough and it'll eventually end up centered around hell, kind of who's in, who's out, that sort of thing, who's up, who's down, and what are the criteria for not going there anyway, you know, and it's just uncanny. And in Bible studies and in classes that I was teaching, it seemed like we always ended up back at that place. And I realized it was the fear talking. We don't need to fear hell as long as we desire the love that God has, because it's always on. He would never reject us. Now, in this online forum, people were allowed to comment, and I got lots of comments back. But one of them stuck in my mind. All it said was, "Good grief, you can't have the good news without the bad news." But I thought about that for a second, and I realized the good news is there is no bad news. That's what this is about. But how do you get to the place that you can actually get your arms around a love that Brennan Manning, quoting G.K. Chesterton, called the furious love of God? The furious love of God. Chesterton wrote that that love was so hot that he couldn't distinguish it from the fires of hell itself. What an image. What an image for love. But written by a man who is coming to understand the intensity, the allness and the onness of this kind of love. The question then remains, how do we get to it? How do we get to a place where this is changing every moment of our lives, every decision we make, every thought that we have? Now, you can imagine this week was pretty intense leading up to today. But Mary and I had an experience at the beginning of the week that brought these choices into really sharp focus. Because basically there are two ways that you can go. And two people, almost exactly 2 weeks ago, died that we knew. And both of their funerals were on Monday morning at the same time, one in Torrance and one here locally. And one of them was my wife's friend or one of her friends from high school, a man who died unexpectedly. And the other was someone that we had known from church for 15 or 20 years who actually committed suicide. So Marion went to one funeral and I went to the other one. And I'm sitting in this funeral and I've known this woman for all this time. And I realized that she had had so many problems that her life was so difficult, traumatized at the beginning of her life, and had probably some sort of brain chemistry imbalance, and struggled and struggled. But she tried so hard. She tried to approach God directly through her faith, through her church, through her religion, you know, through visions and mystical experiences. She was the evangelist to beat all evangelists. She was actually featured on the 700 Club at one point. She a documentary was made of the early part of her life. And she tried so hard, but she couldn't seem to break through. She had become estranged from her husband and from her sons. And the thing that struck me the most, it was maybe one of the most moving moments I've ever had at a memorial service or a funeral, was her sister stood up, who lived out of state, and who had been estranged from her sister. And the first thing she did was thank all of us for allowing her to see a side of her sister that she had never seen before. Because she said she had disowned her, because every time they got on the phone, her sister told her she was going to hell because she wasn't a Christian. Now, I know this woman's heart, and I know what she was trying to do. She was afraid for her sister, afraid for her soul, because she herself was still living in fear. Fear only breeds more fear. It can never bring the love that eradicates the fear. There's a quantum leap that has to happen. She tried to approach God directly through church and religion and through her faith, but she lost the relationships in her life that were closest to her. Now, I want to contrast that with a funeral that my wife went to. This man grew up Catholic, and he nominally stayed in the Catholic faith, and he had a Catholic mass at the end for his memorial service. But church never really ordered his life at all. It wasn't the center of his life. It wasn't what made him really tick. He was the kind of guy that had no problem scheduling a camping trip over the weekend, so he missed Sunday mass. You know, that's just the way he was. But this guy, and I think it's perfect that he was a welder by trade, he had the ability to weld together all of the relationships, all of the lives, wherever he went. He was the go-to guy. He was the guy who you could always count on. He was the guy, if you needed to dig a trench, he was there with a backhoe. He was the guy who was coaching the ball clubs and just everywhere, always. And there's one thing that will tell you everything you need to know about this guy. Whenever he was near, he still visited the elderly mother of his high school girlfriend. Think about that for a minute. How many of you have ever visited the mother of your high school boyfriend or girlfriend? He would do that. What he did was approach the effect of God's love and not try to approach God directly. The effect of God's love are loving, tight, fearless relationships. That's what this man created in his life. And guess what? He got both at the same time. Because what happens is that we can't love God directly. Think about that for a second. We don't love God directly. We love God by loving each and every person that we come into contact with. That's the way this works. Jesus said, love each other. We love each other as we love ourselves. When we become into that kind of unity and connection with each other, we are experiencing God at the same time. It's sort of an indirect thing. It's not the church and it's not the rituals or the worship that we do here. It's not necessarily even prayer time. Those are wonderful means of connection. But God's love is worked out in the streets of our lives, in the relationships that we have. And that is exactly what Jesus meant when he said to seek first the kingdom. Now, that's confusing for us, because when we hear the kingdom of heaven, what do you all think about when you think about what's the kingdom of heaven? It's heaven, right? I mean, it's right there in the title, heaven, kingdom of heaven. So when Jesus says, seek first the kingdom, we're thinking we're supposed to seek first heaven sometime in the afterlife. But here's where the Aramaic and here's where the context of that first century Jewish rabbi comes into play. Because the words in Aramaic that he used for kingdom of heaven were Malkuta Dashmaya. What that literally means is the reign of unity. If you break it down, Malkuta does mean kingdom, but it doesn't refer to a place. It doesn't refer to a territory. It refers to the will of the king. It refers to the principles by which the king rules, his sway, his reign, his dominion, or his will. That's probably the best way for us to look at it. And Dashmaya literally means heaven, but Jews never spoke the name of God directly, so they would use euphemisms, like we use gosh or golly, and instead of saying God, they would say by heaven, because heaven was understood as the place of the Spirit, the place where God reigned, and so that was a euphemism for his name. And Alaha, the actual name in Aramaic of God, means oneness, unity, the reign of unity. The kingdom of heaven is not heaven of the afterlife. The kingdom of heaven is the quality of life that we can have right here and right now with each other when we live in the presence of God's love. Seek that first, and all else will be added. That's what this man was doing, the welder. He was welding the kingdom of heaven literally into the fabric of his community. And that place was absolutely filled. Actually, both funerals were filled to overflowing. But it's amazing the health and the unity in the life that seeks first the kingdom, the effect of God's love. So, how do we do that? It's almost like I have a 2.5-year-old son, and he runs down saying, "What that mean, Mom? What that mean?" You know, he'll bring a book with a picture of bugs on it, and he points to one. What that mean? Or the child that says, why? You know, it's a constant asking. It's easy to say something like this, but what does it really mean? How do we do that? Years and years ago, decades ago, when I was trying to learn how to sing, I had a singing coach who had an interesting way of teaching singing. He said, "I can't teach you how to sing correctly. I can only teach you what it feels like to sing correctly." Subtle difference? Not really. Because when you think about it, when you're learning any sort of instrument, a guitar, a saxophone, a keyboard, or any sort of sport, you're using muscles that you can see, that you can voluntarily control. And even though it's not easy to train those muscles to do something, at least you can see what you're doing. But when you're singing, the instrument is actually inside you. The muscles that you're trying to control are muscles that you can't see. You've never really voluntarily controlled. How do you do that? How do you tell your vocal folds to do this? And how do you tell your diaphragm to do that? But what he would do would be listen to how I sang. And when he heard a tone produced correctly, he would stop me and say, "Okay, that's what it felt like to sing correctly. Memorize the sensation, reproduce the sensation, and then you will reproduce the correct tone." So much wisdom in that. Because what is this life about? How can you tell someone to seek first the kingdom? How do you tell that mechanism to work? How do you tell someone to love God with their whole heart, mind, and strength? What does that mean? How do you do that? You do it by seeking first the effect of the kingdom, the effect of God's love. We know what that feels like. We know what a tight relationship between people feels like. That's what we need to go for. Jesus said in John 3, when he was blowing Nicodemus' mind, remember, telling him that he needed to be born again, he said, "The wind blows where it wishes. You hear the sound of it, but you don't know where it's coming from, and you don't know where it's going. And so too are those who are born of the Spirit." What he's telling us is that the wind, and again, Aramaic, the wind in Aramaic is ruha, but it doesn't just mean wind. Aramaic has many different layers of meaning. It means wind, it means breath, and it means spirit all at the same time. So think of the double entendre and the wordplay that Jesus is using here. The wind blows where it wishes. The spirit blows where it wishes. God's breath blows where it wishes. And then to wish, the word there is sebyana. And sevyana can mean to wish, to desire, to will, but it also means deepest purpose. It's the kind of purpose, it's like planets spinning in their orbits. There's nothing they can do but to spin in those orbits. They're ordained. It is that deepest purpose that can't be altered or changed in any way. It's like a baby's DNA, you know, the embryo that will always grow into a baby. Unless it's a mouse embryo, and then it'll grow into a mouse. But it's that deepest purpose. It's the track that it's on. That's the idea of sevyana. So really what we're saying is God's Spirit blows according to its purpose, or better, the purpose of God's Spirit is to blow, to move, to always be in motion. What did James say about faith? Without works, it's dead. Faith is only alive when it's in motion. God's Spirit is only alive when it's in motion and it's moving through our lives. This is what he's talking about. If we want to try to understand what it feels like, we have to realize that we can't see the wind. We can hear it, but we can't see it. But we can see its effect. When we see trees swaying, we know the wind is there. And when we see tight relationship, when we see happy families, we know the Spirit is there. Seek that first. And then you get everything. That's what Jesus is talking about. This is not an event in our lives. You don't learn it overnight. It took me 10 years to even get to the point where I started to understand. And I didn't change overnight. I've been changing ever since. And I can tell you that it's been a wonderful last 7 years watching the fear dissipate in my life. But it's a process. It's a long process. And either we get on the journey or we don't. But nobody can do this for you. And nobody can do this for me. Some things in life are just not transferable, right? If I want to make you free and you're locked up, I can throw the keys into your cell, but I can't make you pick them up and use them. I can open the door of your cell and I can drag you down to a street corner, but I can't make you free. Jesus says that there is a truth out there that will make you free. What is that truth? It's the truth that God's love can't be turned off. It's the truth that there's nothing we can do not to be loved or not to be forgiven except not want to be loved or forgiven. I suppose if there's any definition of an unforgivable sin, that's it. If you don't want it. Because for God to coerce anything in any of us would change the definition of love itself. These are the kinds of things that is the purpose of our lives, I believe. I have come to be convinced that our lives here are meant to learn to build the kind of relationships that reflect who God is. That's what we're doing. It's no more complicated than that. We make it complicated, yes, I know. But what we're going to try to do here is to simplify. What we're going to try to do here is to get back to the roots of what Jesus' message was really about. And the only way that you can know, you can't read it right out of an English Bible, because there's a whole worldview and culture shift. And when I get back and I have actually gotten into the context, gotten into the sandals of Jesus' first hearers, this is where it comes alive for me. This is where I realize that a consistent picture of God from the Old Testament to the New Testament is being presented here. And it's always the same. It's always built on this unconditional, incredibly furious love. And that's what we're going to try to do in here. But you know, we need some teeth and traction. It's all good and well to talk about this stuff. But where do we really get into the nitty-gritty of really trying to make this work, to get on a path, some sort of process in our lives that allows us to be able to start to feel these effects? And there are two models that we're going to use to try to order what we do in here. And one of them is that for the last 3 or 4 years, I've been working with Jeff and Lisa in the area of alcohol and drug addiction recovery. And the 12 steps of AA are an incredible tool. And I didn't know much about them before I got introduced in this work. But as I started speaking about them from a spiritual point of view, I realized that these 12 steps, taken out of their context in terms of just alcoholism, are a perfect blueprint for the process that we can go through. Those steps outline a way through and around the blockages in our life, around the fear, around the things that stop us from getting where we want to go. And so that's one model that we're going to use, but there's another one. And it's called EPIC, E-P-I-C, and that's an acronym that stands for experiential, participatory, image-based, and communal. All right, think about those four. Experiential, participatory, image-based, and communal. Think about how your kids learn. Kids are total experience. You know, give them a toy. Do you think they're going to stop and read the directions? There's no propositional language here. They're not even going to listen to you try to give them the directions. They're going to grab the thing, and they're going to start poking and pulling and pushing and doing all that stuff. It's all learned by doing. It's experience. Think about participatory. Think about how kids of this generation basically enjoy any venue. When they go to see a concert, when they go to hear music, do they sit politely in neat rows and listen? Heck no. They're jumping up and down. They're running up to the stage. They're trying to touch, and they're, you know, doing the banging dance thing that they do. They're as much a part of the show as the show is. It's all about participation. Image-based. Ah, my gosh. Internet. Everything is images. Images are flashing so fast in commercials now that they're practically subliminal. Think how fast, you know, when a movie or a sitcom was shot back in the 50s or the 60s, basically you had a set camera on a scene that would hold there for sometimes 5 or 10 minutes, I Love Lucy, which is hold there, and all the action happened within that frame. Now you got handheld cameras moving around, you got quick cuts and all this stuff. It's all images. It's like, as if the words are almost superfluous. It's the images that are telling the story. You know, with the videos, with the iPods, with all this stuff, kids are focused, the newest generations are focused on imagery and not on the word, the spoken word or the printed word. And then communal. There's a fascinating thing, you know, back in the even medieval times, but in certainly ancient times, societies were communal. Especially Eastern societies. The individual exists to serve the community. The community did not exist to ensure the rights of the individual, as we have now here in the West. It was all the other way around. When there was a funeral, everyone would come and they would just dump flowers on top of the casket or the bier that was holding the body. And they were all just in a big pile. We're getting back to that now. Think about when Princess Diana died. What was the shrines, the impromptu shrines that happened right in front of Buckingham Palace? Do you remember? They were big piles of flowers that the kids would come and lay. But there was a difference, a subtle difference maybe. They're all wrapped in plastic. Each kid brought their bunch of flowers wrapped in plastic and put it on the pile. Almost as if to say, yes, I want to be in community again, but I still want to retain a little bit of my individuality too at the same time, you know. But kids, electronically, the MySpace, the internet again, text messaging, it's all about connection. It's all about community again. The newest generations, this is the way that they learn. This is the way they are experiencing reality. This is why the old model of the church no longer can speak effectively to the youngest people among us, because they're not EPIC. The way that we've done it before, it wasn't experiential, it was propositional. It was a creed or a theology through which spiritual things were conveyed. It wasn't participatory, it was representational. Someone at the pulpit talking in neat rows of people sitting and listening, receiving one-way communication. It wasn't image-based, it was word-based. And it wasn't so much communal as rooted in the individual. This is why we're having this mismatch right now. But here's one more thing that I want you to think about. This newest generation called the postmodern generation that is becoming very EPIC is the same as the pre-modern generation. The world of the ancients was EPIC as well. When you think about the way Jesus taught, he didn't teach a theology. He didn't teach a creed. He taught a way of life. It was a way of living that was experiential. It was participatory. You had to get involved. Come follow me. Drop your nets and follow me. No, let me bury my father first. Let the dead bury their dead. Come follow me. It's about participation. Image-based, story after story, and parable and word picture. That's how Jesus taught. How does God teach? Visions and dreams, right? Images that we get. And community, of course, community. Jesus was the ultimate in community. Epic is going to be another way that we're going to try to order what it is that we do in the effect. Experiential. Now, I want to just go through some of the things. Each one of these, if it doesn't order the choices that we make, then it might as well not be a model for us. It needs to order our thinking, inform our choices. And this is what we're going to try to do. In the experiential realm versus the propositional, to know God, which is foundational in both the Old and New Testament, is to yada in Aramaic. And it doesn't refer to thoughts in your head. Actually, the root word of yada is the word for hand. To know something in Aramaic is to be able to handle it. All right? It's like a master craftsman. They can feel the tools in their hand even when they're not there. Or a musician. You can feel the strings under your fingers. That is to know God. It was all experiential. And God's will, we always think of as a what. What is it that I need to do? But God's will really is a how. It doesn't matter what you do. It only matters how you do it. If you do it with the right how, any what will do. This is the kind of thing that we're talking about. So, teeth and traction. What are we going to try to do? Well, we're going to work in here to help change our worldviews, to be able to see what the original languages are telling us about Jesus' message, so that we can clear away any of the blockages that we have to getting to an experiential way of actually meeting God. Our society has become really legal. You know, we as children of Roman law, we approach things in a legalistic way. But legalism creates passivity and a vicarious attitude. That doesn't work. There's nothing that someone can do for us. We need to do it for ourselves, and that's where we need to go. Here in the effect, we want to be ministry first and church later. In fact, we don't even really want to call ourselves a church. We really want to call ourselves a faith community. When you think about some of the main words, church, Christian, service, all of those are passive, aren't they? Because a Christian has come to be someone who believes in a creed that saves. You know, you just believe the creed and you're saved. There's nothing you can do. There's nothing you can do. God does it all, right? That's the vicarious nature of it. As far as a church is concerned, well, that has now come to mean the building or the institution. But you know that there's really no such thing as a Christian church or a Christian company? I hear people say, I work for a Christian company. It's like, no, you don't. A company is just an institution that has cash flow and overhead and, assets and certain bylaws that make it run. And a church as an institution is exactly the same way. It can't be anything. The people inside it can be. You can work for a company of Christians, and you can go to a church or a gathering of Christians. This is the way that we need to start changing what it is that we think. And a service, well, if you're being serviced, then you're sitting there and someone else is doing the work and you're receiving, right? But a gathering instead of a service, that implies some sort of motion. A faith community instead of a church, and a follower of Jesus, or a follower of the way, which is what the first followers of Jesus actually called themselves, instead of a Christian, implies motion. Now, obviously, this is just semantics. This is just wordplay, unless we actually make it work in our lives. And this is what we're going to try to do. In terms of participatory versus representational, you know, here, what we want to try to do is to have as flat an org chart as possible. There's not going to be any senior pastor. There's not going to be any pyramidal shape to this thing. It's going to be flat as we possibly can make it. Yes, you know, we're going to have to go by whatever state and federal laws apply and the IRS and all that. But this is going to be something where everybody is understood as equal. And even to the way that we're sitting, I never want to have a stage here. I never want to have somebody up above. We're all together. We're all worshiping together. Some are holding instruments and some are not. You know, it doesn't matter. Everybody's equal. There will be a leadership group, of course, but everyone should be accessible, and nobody should be in control, and nobody should be held up. We can differentiate ourselves by our roles. You know, if I'm teaching, then I'm a teacher. But that doesn't make me in any way, shape, or form any different than anybody else here. that's one way that we can start to encourage participation. We want to have a flat week as well. Sunday is not the be-all and end-all of our spiritual experience. It's just one more day in the week. In fact, what we want to do here on Sunday is to celebrate what happened the other 6 days of the week, rather than try to get some infilling that will allow us to cope with the next 6 days of the week. That's not what we want to do. You know, there should be so much happening that we have to talk about when we get going. And one of the things that we'll get some paperwork to you maybe next week or in the following weeks that'll kind of outline. You can go on the website. It's there, too. But when the effect becomes full-blown, there's much more than just a faith community, much more than just a Sunday service. We want to have a life skills school that will help people get the cultural literacy and everything that they need from whatever place that they're at to be able to go out and be competitive in life. If that means teaching them how to dress and how to write a resume and how to type and how to take an interview, we'll do that. We want that not only for those people who are addicted or maybe homeless, but also for children who aren't getting that in school. They're just not. My daughter is not being taught how to type in high school. I can't believe it. We live at keyboards, and she types like this. She's really fast, but it's still like this. You know, why aren't kids being taught? I was taught back in the 70s. We didn't even have computers. Computers weren't even a twinkle in anybody's eye back then, but we learned how to type. These are things that kids need. We need a referral network because we don't want to go out and reinvent the wheel all the time. There are people out there that are doing amazing work. We need to research that, find out who they are, so when someone comes to us, we know where to send them if we can't help them. We want to have a treatment facility for alcoholics and substance abusers, even a homeless shelter at some point. But a homeless shelter that takes people who want to be off the street and gives them the skills through the Life Skills School to get what they need to get off the street and mainstream back into society if that's what they want to do. These are ways that we will be a ministry first and a church or a faith community afterwards. There's a wonderful church in the Washington, D.C. area called Church of the Savior. And basically, it's a loose collection of 9 ministries. One of them is a retreat center. One of them is a soup kitchen. One of them is a school. One of them is an addiction center and so on and so forth. When you join the Church of the Savior, you join one of those ministries because you believe in that ministry. Oh, and by the way, yes, we also worship together at our facility. Worship becomes the byproduct of the work that we're doing to make people's lives better and not the other way around. You know, we don't want to go looking for excuses or reasons to try to keep our people busy. You know, if we believe in this work, we do it together. And then we celebrate it on Sunday. And Jeff, who's coming up here later, I'm talking long, aren't I? Is going to be the one, because he's at the forefront of all this. He is in the trenches with the homeless and with the addicts and with the alcoholics and working. And he's going to be the one who's spearheading all of this. Participatory. Image-based. We want to work as Jesus worked. We want to focus on life experience. We want to focus on the living revelation of God, not something that you read out of a book. But as you move into relationships, as you move into the field, you're going to feel something. You're going to learn something about the living God that you would never get anywhere else. And you couldn't get from someone else. It's first person or it's no person. And we want to foster those kind of relationships. Theology in here will only be a means to being able to clear the decks so that God's voice can speak to you. It's never an end in itself. And it's never a litmus test for God's love or for salvation. Theology is not and was never intended to be that. It became that. But that's something that we need to change. And of course, communal. Everyone here, or everyone is welcome here, is what I want to say. Everyone is welcome here. That may make things a little uncomfortable once in a while, but everyone is welcome. Again, there is no litmus test. We are a community here. We exist for each other. So if you're an alcoholic, if you're an addict, if you're divorced, if you're remarried, if you're an overworker, an overeater, an overspender, hey, even if you're a smoker, you can belong here. It doesn't matter. Of course, the next question is, well, what about people who are living in sin? Okay, what about the people who are homosexuals? Who about the people that are living with their boyfriend or girlfriend? Well, you know what? Where else would you want them to be? We don't fix anybody, do we? We can't fix anybody. What we would say to everybody who comes in here is come get on the journey with us. See what that does. See what God tells you and see where it takes you. There's no time limit to getting fixed. You come, you partake. Our job is not to fix. Our job is simply to love, and love means acceptance. Jesus never discriminated. Jesus got called on the carpet for hanging around with the wrong people. We want to hang around with the wrong people too. We really do. But we want to develop a really tight, wonderful community at the same time. We will protect our people. If someone comes in who is abusive, if someone comes in who is disruptive, of course, we will protect our people, and that person will be asked to leave. But we always want to leave a trail of breadcrumbs back. We want to leave a way back. No one gets disfellowshipped forever, but they have to be able to be part of the group, and that would be the criteria. I suppose there's one other thing that I need to talk about. Let's see. Are you guys all right? Can I go a little bit longer here? Because what we really wanted to do is kind of lay down some of what we believe in. And this next thing is a huge one. It's tithing. You know, tithing has become a big deal in the contemporary church. And it's looked at as a commandment from God. And the reason that it's looked at is because it appears in the Old Testament law, tithing, the 10%. And the interesting thing is that it doesn't appear in the New Testament at all. Paul never speaks of it, and the only time that Jesus speaks of it is kind of in a derogatory way, saying that tithing as a commandment is not enough. There is something more that is required than just your 10%. And the other interesting thing is that there really wasn't just one tithe in ancient Israel. There were really at least or up to three tithes. And if you add them all up, it wasn't 10%, but closer to 23%. And that didn't include the sabbatical years and the jubilees where you had to free the slaves and let your land go fallow and forgive debts and all the other stuff that there really isn't any indication that the ancient Jews even did. You know, it was pretty burdensome. In the fourth century or so, the Christian church actually made the tithe official. And by medieval times, it was a tax like any other. And if you didn't pay it, you were, you know, guilty of imprisonment or worse. But it became an actual tax. And part of the Protestant Reformation was to break away from that system. But the interesting thing to me is that still we tell each other that this is a commandment from God and it's right in the book. And the Old Testament law, how do we pick and choose? I mean, don't we instinctively know that we can eat shellfish? Don't we instinctively know that it's okay to eat pork? Don't we instinctively know that certain things that were done in the Old Testament no longer need to be abided by presently? I just want to read some of this to you. There is a letter that is going around the internet, an open letter that was written to a pastor who was using Old Testament law to justify Defensive Marriage Act, okay? And so what he wrote, and this is dripping with sarcasm, and if it's a little bit offensive, but it just makes the point so well. He writes to him and says that, thank you so much for educating people regarding God's law, but I do need some advice from you, however, regarding some other elements of God's laws and how to follow them. Number one, Leviticus 25:44 states that I may possess slaves, both male and female, provided they are purchased from neighboring nations. A friend of mine claims this applies to Mexicans, but not Canadians. Can you clarify? Why can't I own Canadians? Number two, I would like to sell my daughter into slavery as sanctioned in Exodus 21:7. In this day and age, what do you think would be a fair price for her? Number three, I know that I am allowed no contact with a woman while she is in her period of menstrual uncleanness, Leviticus 15. The problem is, how do I tell? I have tried asking, but most women take offense. Number four, when I burn a bull on the altar as a sacrifice, I know it creates a pleasing odor to the Lord, Leviticus 1:9. The problem is my neighbors. They claim the odor is not pleasing to them. Should I smite them? Five, I have a neighbor who insists on working on the Sabbath. Exodus 35:2 clearly states that he should be put to death. Am I morally obligated to kill him myself, or should I ask the police to do it? Six, a friend of mine feels that even though eating shellfish is an abomination, Leviticus 11:10, it is a lesser abomination than homosexuality. I don't agree. Can you settle this? Are there degrees of abominations? 7, Leviticus 21:20 states that I may not approach the altar of God if I have a defect in my sight. I have to admit that I wear reading glasses. Does my vision have to be 20/20, or is some wiggle room available here? Most of my male friends get their hair trimmed, including the hair around their temples, even though this is expressly forbidden by Leviticus 19:27. How should they die? Number 9, I know from Leviticus 11:6-8 that touching the skin of a dead pig makes me unclean, but may I still play football if I wear gloves? Number 10, my uncle has a farm. He violates Leviticus 19:19 by planting two different crops in the same field, as does his wife by wearing garments made of two different kinds of thread, cotton polyester blend. He also tends to curse and blaspheme a lot. Is it really necessary that we go to all the trouble of getting the whole town together to stone them, Leviticus 24:10, 16? Couldn't we just burn them to death at a private party affair like we do with people who sleep with their in-laws, Leviticus 20:14? I know you have studied these things extensively and thus enjoy considerable expertise in such matters, so I am confident you can help. Thank you for reminding us again, that God's word is eternal and unchanging. I think if you look in the dictionary under sarcasm, this letter would be there. But he makes excellent points, and I looked up every one of these references. He's dead on. How do we pick and choose in the Old Testament law? Either it is binding in its entirety, or it's not. But you can't pick and choose. I mean, it's obvious why the church picked the tithe as one rule that would stay. You know, when the Old Testament says, love God with your whole heart, mind, and strength, and your neighbor as yourself, that is binding. But the rest is situational, and we have to understand the difference. And we have to be consistent. Either take it all or leave it all. But you can't pick and choose. The problem with the tithe is that when it becomes a commandment of God, the first thing that happens is it becomes a legalistic tax. And as soon as it's a tax, as soon as it's enforced, it defeats the purpose of everything that giving is supposed to be. If it's not volitional, if it's not voluntary, if it's not coming out of a place in the center of your soul, if it's not part of the unity that you want to have with that person, then it's meaningless. It cannot be that. And if it's not legalism, then it becomes superstition. You know, what do we say to each other? Well, you can't outgive God. Well, what does that mean? That means I hope that if I give, that God will give back to me tenfold. I hope that somehow there's going to be some sort of quid pro quo arrangement. And that, again, defeats the purpose of what giving's about because it becomes self-focused. Enforcing a tithe does harm to everything that giving is supposed to be about, everything that kingdom is supposed to be about. And so that being said, of course, if we're going to exist as a cooperative community here, we need to support that community. And we're not going to pass a basket ever in here. We're not going to put that kind of pressure. There's a donation box on the table over there, and it's available. And if the work here is something that you believe in, if the community is here that is something that you believe in, then support it. And support it to whatever extent that you want to. That's fine. Our job is to make this community something that you do want to support, that you do want to be part of, to communicate to you the work that we're doing that may be important for you to see continue. And then that's where the real meaning of giving actually takes place. These are ways that we have come up with so far to try to conduct this experiment that we're conducting. We don't know how this all works out. You know, there are more things that are going to come up that we don't know about. But the one thing that we do know is that we are here to try to make each other's lives better. If we're not doing that, then I don't know what we're doing. And we're going to do everything that we can to make that happen, to make this community happen. I have one last thing that I want to read to you because I love James Taylor. I admit it. He wrote a song called That's Why I'm Here. And in the first few stanzas, he says, person to person and man to man, I'm back in touch with my long-lost friend. Listen to reason and understand and think of me from way back when. He said, me and Melissa, we fell out of love. We ran out of luck. Seems like lightning struck. I've been thinking of leaving, but I can't raise a buck. James, I'm wondering, can I borrow your truck? I said, that's why I'm here. Got no better reason. That's why I'm standing here before you. That's why I'm here. That's why we're here. To make each other's lives better. That's it. To bind each other in relationship and always leave a relationship better than you found it. Never leave a relationship worse than you found it. If we can do that, we're going to be touching the face of God. We're going to be entering kingdom. That's what this is all about. What's the effect of one drop? It's to ripple out across the entire surface of whatever body it falls into. That's why we're here. To live the effect of God's love in our lives. And to let that effect ripple out and touch everyone. That's why we're here. And I'm so glad that you're here today too. Let's pray. Father God, it's just indescribable that we can sit here in this place and be in one accord in your name, under your name, Lord. And we are so grateful that we can do this. We are so thankful for the people who made it happen. And we just ask that you would guide us, show us the way to being able to live the effect of your love. We thank you in advance, Lord, in Jesus' name. Amen. Like you need to.